I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. More than a year and a half after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, the recovery process is still ongoing. The University of Central Florida chapter of the group Engineers Without Borders is constructing water purification systems in Haiti. We'll talk with some of the students about their experiences there. Plus, we go inside the world of competitive dominoes. The first ever Orlando International Domino Open tournament recently came to the area. We'll find out what it's all about, and I get schooled on how to play competition-level dominoes. Those stories ahead on Intersection. Today, we're talking about what progress is taking place in Haiti more than a year and a half after a deadly earthquake rocked that island nation. I'm joined by several current and former students from the University of Central Florida. Andrew Ivey is president of the University of Central Florida's chapter of Engineers Without Borders. Andrew, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Also joined by James DeMarco, recent graduate with a master's degree in mechanical engineering from UCF. James, good to have you.
Glad to be here.
And Maya Basquin, who is a sophomore majoring in industrial engineering and a first-generation Haitian-American. Maya, great to have you in.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, James and Maya, you traveled to Haiti in May to work on a project that is meant to deliver clean water to a village named Mère Brignole. About 300 people live there, and this is a village about 6 hours outside of Port-au-Prince. So tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing there, and tell me if I've said that name right.
It was close. It's actually Mère Brignole. Approximately 30 miles from Port-au-Prince. However, it's about a six-hour drive through very mountainous territory, heavy traffic through the city of Port-au-Prince. And once you get outside of the city, then you start to travel over some really rough roads.
To say the least.
To say the least. And so what do you see as you go out there? What is it like? Is it very rural? There's not the kind of sprawl that you see in somewhere like Central Florida, Maya?
Yes. Well, when you first head outside of the airport, you actually see a lot of markets. You see plenty of people selling on the streets, whether it's food, jewelry, clothing, I mean, anything that they can try to do. You also have a lot of people walking around. Everyone's busy, so everyone's going somewhere at some point. And there's also a lot of begging that you see from the streets. Once you get into the more rural areas, you will see several people doing more farming, more, communicating. Everyone's out there kind of just fellowshipping, saying, hey, hello. We had a driver who just knew everybody who was on the way there, and he was basically getting bananas and sugarcane and shaking hands with people along the stops and saying hello. It's pretty friendly for the most part.
So you went over there. What were you doing? What was the actual goal of this water project?
Well, as you already explained to everyone, we're with Engineers Without Borders, and we actually have a water project in Mère Brignole. So while we were there, we were continuing the implementation of some water cisterns that we had there, six water cisterns. We were putting up gutters. We were implementing a first flush system. And our president, who knows like way more about that, he'll go into detail about it all. But we were basically just getting a memorandum of understanding with all of the other villagers that we were there to build for and starting the implementation process.
So, James, what's the situation in Mère Brignole? Is it a place that is lacking in water resources? Is that why you were there?
Oh, to say the least. The water situation is that essentially everybody is capturing rainwater. There are no sources of fresh water close by. It's about a 2 or 3 hour walk to the nearest spring where somewhat clean water can be found. But as I said, most people rely on rainwater catchment for their water needs. The cisterns that are in place, there are some cisterns that are there. However, they're rather exposed to runoff and thereby contamination. They're open air, and so the water is of not great quality in these cisterns.
So, Andrew, how do you preserve the water quality in these cisterns? Are these above ground? Is that as opposed to being in the ground?
Well, thanks to nonprofit that had been there 10 years ago or so, there are existing underground cisterns, but they're open to the air, and so you get mosquitoes, algae, tadpoles, birds, and it's really not fit for drinking at all.
It's becoming an aquatic habitat.
A cesspool, yes. Mm-hmm. So our solution is twofold. We asked them, what do we need? On our first trip, we've been working there for 3 years. And we asked them, what do they need? Hands down, it was water. They need clean water, and they need more of it. So to address that, we, in May, James and Maya and 15 other students traveled down to Haiti, where they installed 34 biosand filters.
What are those? Explain how those work. Right. Biosand filter sounds pretty high-tech.
All right. Well, actually, it is, but it's also kind of the opposite. Haiti is a graveyard of failed water projects. Just on my first trip to Haiti, I saw 3 failed water projects where it was in disrepair and unused. And it's mostly because people don't know how to operate it. Parts will break down, chemicals will run out, and it's really not sustainable. So we saw this, and our mantras kind of keep it simple, comma, stupid. And we went with something that does not require chemicals or electricity, and that is the biosand filter. These are simple concrete boxes. They're about waist high, full of sand. And what happens is on the first 2 inches, it's like this insane bacterium world. And then the rest of the microbes on the way down through the sand, they starve. And it comes out like 98% clean. Had a drop of bleach, 100%.
And so it really, the majority of the work that's being done, though, is by sand.
It is.
And it's really just regular sand?
Well, close. It's, I read like a 150-page report on sand grain distribution sizes. It's great stuff for an environmental engineer, but maybe not the most entertaining light reading. But it is important to have the right kind of sand. It cannot be limestone. It cannot have salt. It cannot have organic, so no beach sand, no river sand, no sedimentary rock. It has to be crushed, metamorphic, or igneous rock to work just right.
And so, James, does this mean then if these cisterns are up and running, does this mean the work is done then in this village?
Oh, I wouldn't say so. We intended to not just install 5,000 gallons worth of water storage, but also to educate the people in the village to build these cisterns on their own. So we need to go back and follow up and see how that process is going to see if it's in fact feasible for the residents of the village to get the materials and to create these cisterns. And if not, then what can we do to make that happen?
And how many more do you think would be needed?
Well, it would be great if every single village in the entire area were able to have their own cistern. So.
And how many people are able to take advantage of just one cistern?
I would say, well, it's 800 gallons worth of water storage, so it's going to depend on how much rainfall is being received in the area. But probably one cistern per household would be ideal.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. We're talking about Haiti today. We're getting an update on some progress there, some positive news out of Haiti a year and a half after the earthquake there. We're talking with students from the University of Central Florida. Engineers Without Borders is the group, and they've been working on water purification over in a small village called Mère Brignole. Maya, you are of Haitian descent. You know, what was it like for you to go back there to Haiti? Was this your first time? And what did you experience? What did you see? How did it change you?
Well, it was actually my second time going to Haiti. The first time I had ever visited was when I was 8 years old, and that was in about the year 2000. So it was very much different than it was when we went
in change.
May. Yes, a huge change. For one thing, back in the day, when you first would leave the airport, you would see the palace. When you first drove through,
and I mean, it was
beautiful.
Palace.
Yes, the presidential palace, and I mean, it was beautiful. It was grassy. I mean, the flowers were just radiant, and it was just a nice place to be. You know, you would see Haiti, and you'd be like, "Wow, this is the first image. This is the first perception." But now, when you go there, you immediately see beggars clinging to the fences of the airport, and you see, UN soldiers with their rifles standing around, as well as the tanks, you know, driving through the cities. And, I mean, you can still see the debris from the earthquake. It's not as bad as, you know, the first few months after the earthquake, but it's pretty bad. As for me, it was pretty funny because I am dark-skinned, I'm black, you know, but they weren't so sure if I was Haitian, so they would kind of test each other, would whisper to each other, you know, is she Haitian? And then I'd go up to them and be like, yes, I'm Haitian, you know, speak to them in Creole. And it was great because I got to speak with them. You know, not all of the members had the privilege of being able to have direct communication with everybody. You know, a lot of people had to have translators, but it was just great to be able to have some personal conversations with some of the villagers there.
So, Andrew, why this village of Mère Brignole? How did they get selected among all the other places that surely need help over in Haiti?
Well, there are a lot of places that need help. Engineers Without Borders is actually a national organization, and we are but a student chapter, one of at least seven in the state of Florida. There are at least two professional chapters as well, and each chapter has its own particular partner village someplace in the world. And there's an application process to a Father Charles from the region in Haiti, along with an existing nonprofit called HERO, based in Atlanta. They applied to EWB, Engineers Without Borders, asking for someone to come to the region and apply their skills and help with the water crisis there. And so 3 years ago, we picked up the project. We applied. And since Haiti is just on our doorstep, we felt that that would be a great place to go.
And interesting, you make that point of you started work 3 years ago, which means you were working before the earthquake hit in 2010. What are the changes you've seen with that before and after period?
Unfortunately, I have not been to Haiti since the earthquake. I was in Port-au-Prince 3 days before the earthquake, but I dodged that. It's unfortunate. We actually had to stop operations of our project for an entire year because the earthquake happened, and then there was the outbreak, and there was civil unrest. And so for an entire year, we were thinking that we're just going to have to drop this project after we put in 2.5 years of work into this project.
What surprised you the most about being in Haiti?
Actually, the most shocking thing about going to Haiti is not actually the trip to Haiti, it's the return. The culture shock for me personally, every time I've ever been, has actually occurred when I've come back. And you take into account, you know, your house and your life and your car and your money, and you have endless amounts of clean water from the tap. You live in an air-conditioned house. You have a plush bed that you have all to yourself. You don't have to share your room with, you know, 10 other people. And you just think, what in the world did I ever do to deserve this? And, of course, the answer is not a thing. You just happen to be lucky to be born in the right place at the right time.
To Andrew's point, our former vice president, Johnny Foley, told us about an experience he had where one of the children in the village asked him, in America, does everyone have a cistern at their house? And it was just so difficult for him to have to be asked that question and not really know what to say, because it's not just a cistern that catches water and then you have to purify it, etc. We've got clean water running into our house on a daily basis. So it is a bit of a shock to come back and realize how lucky you have it.
A completely different system to think about. What about for you, Maya, coming back, going there? What stands out for you?
Before I had headed over there, I had a Sunday school teacher who told me that once I return, I'm going to feel like I must be there. And it's funny because she's absolutely right. I have this heightened sense of an obligation to Haiti now. It's like I know that I've got to go back. I've got to do more. And like James said, it's just become so personal, you know. So I guess that's basically what I would say. It's just a heightened sense of obligation for me.
Well, Andrew Ivey, what is next for Engineers Without Borders? Will you be sending a group over there soon?
That's an exciting question. The design process is always a fluid thing. We tried composting latrines. It didn't take. Filters, they liked them, so we expanded that. Cisterns seems like it's a go. We might tweak the design a bit. But in the future, we'll probably go back over spring break, probably April or March. I have to check my calendar. And probably expand on the filters front, tweak the design of the cisterns, maybe fund a small business of people trying to use solar disinfection. But it is still all about the project in Haiti. And we're not going to leave. We're going to be there for some time to come.
Well, Andrew, that's good news to hear. We've been speaking with Andrew Ivey, who's president of the University of Central Florida's chapter of Engineers Without Borders. We're also joined by James DeMarco, recent graduate with a master's degree in mechanical engineering, and Maya Basquin, who is a sophomore majoring in industrial engineering and a first-generation Haitian-American. Guys, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having us.
Coming up on Intersection, inside the first ever Orlando International Domino Open Tournament here on 90.7 WMFE-FM. If you think about what you were doing last weekend, maybe you watched some football or lit up the grill, relaxed with the family. Well, in Orlando, though, top domino players from around the world came to the first ever Orlando International Domino Open Tournament. The event drew players from the U.S., Puerto Rico, Cuba, and Dominican Republic. Armando Capo kept the scores at the tournament, and he's here with me now as a member of the World Domino Council, which organized the event. Armando, welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. So, Armando, the stereotype here in Florida of dominoes is a couple of old guys in South Florida or maybe Ybor City in Tampa. They're sitting around in those Cuban-style shirts, smoking cigars, playing dominoes. So I had no idea there was an international competitive circuit for dominoes. How did this happen?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. There is a lot of federations around the world that promote the sports of domino. And on some of these tournaments, you actually have delegations from different countries that travel and participate in these tournaments. And what we're trying to put together at the World Domino Council is a group that does a world ranking for dominoes that doesn't exist yet.
So that no one knows the global rankings right now for domino players.
That's correct.
How are you putting that together? What is the challenge of putting that together?
Well, the biggest challenge is attracting the federations around the world to join the World Domino Council and send us tournament results so that we can keep track of who's winning what.
So right now, who's one of the leaders in dominoes? Is there a country that is just dominant in the game?
I am not sure. There's a lot of good players around the world. The Venezuela team does good. The Puerto Rico team does good. Cuba, I couldn't tell you who would be in the lead.
Well, let me ask you about that, because it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, Venezuela, Puerto Rico, Cuba is good. And so often we see this game kind of in the Caribbean and the Latin American countries. Why is it so popular in those countries?
Well, you know, we start playing domino since we're kids, and it's a family thing. Every time the family gets together, we have the dominoes there, and so we're sharing and playing dominoes, and so we grow up with it. But this is, like I said, it's a world thing, and there is actually a big tournament that a lot of people from around the world go to in Russia, and so it's not a local Caribbean thing.
It really is an international
scale event. Yes, it is.
Well, take me inside that domino culture. You know, you mentioned you start playing when you're young. Is it just for fun, or is it competitive early on?
It is for fun, but it gets really competitive at the family level.
At the family level.
Oh, yeah. Domino is a very spirited sport, and that's why one of the reasons when we do the actual tournaments, there is strict rules. No talking, no signaling. Your hands have to be below the table. So because we get really into it, and it could get really, really spirited if we let it.
So no gesturing or anything. I wonder, is it easy to cheat in dominoes?
When we are playing with family, yes.
How do you cheat in dominoes?
Oh, you can.
I'm not trying to give away any secrets here, but I'm just wondering.
You try to let your partner know what you have.
Mm.
And if your partner knows what you have, then you can really block the plays for the other two players.
So there really is a strategy behind it.
Oh, yes, yes.
So when it comes to your family, who's the top player?
I'd say my older brother.
Your older brother.
He's really good. but I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good also.
Now, the World Domino Council has organized tournaments for several years in New York. This year, you're coming to Orlando for the first time. Why did you come to Central Florida?
Well, Orlando has a big Hispanic population, and so that's always a good starting point. And from there, try to grow it to other people. But we know that there's many domino clubs locally, and so we're trying to pull all of those together.
Well, let's go across the room, and we'll try to teach me how to play dominoes.
Okay, let's do that.
So we've moved across the hall into our talk studio to play a game of dominoes. Armando is going to teach me how to do this. And Armando, you've brought some guests with you to help us play this match because you need four people to play it.
Yes, we have with us Pedro Julio Alicea, and he's our main judge for our tournament.
Hey, Pedro.
And Jose Lugo, who's our vice president for the World Domino Council.
Hey,
they're going to be joining us.
Okay, great. So walk us through the game. We've got the dominoes on the desk. They're all face down.
Okay, so we got the chips facing down on the table. First thing we do is remove them real good. We don't want anyone to know which chip is which.
Shuffling the deck.
We're shuffling the deck. And this is one of the most colorful parts of the game. All right? And usually you push them off a little when you're done. So you're indicating that you're done. Okay? Now, what we do is everyone will grab seven chips.
Seven chips.
And usually the one that shuffles is the last one to grab chips.
Okay.
All right? Just to make it fair, because I moved them, I might know where something is.
Okay. So I just grab seven at once?
Just grab seven, any seven.
Okay, so
and they'll grab their seven.
Four. Okay, I've got seven.
There we go. I got seven, too.
Okay. So everyone's lining them up.
Usually we have a holder where you place your chips.
Okay.
All right? And you try to make it so that the others don't see your chips.
It's kind of like cards.
Kind of like cards, exactly. All right, so now for the first hand, whoever has the double six is the first one to place the chips on the table. He has it, so he places the first chip.
Okay.
Okay, that was Jose Lugo. Now, it's always we're going counterclockwise, just like cards. And Pedro Julio will now play his hand.
And so you've got to match the number, right?
You have to match one of the two ends. By the way, when the double six comes out, the player that puts it on the table has to put it across or diagonal from himself.
Mm.
Okay?
Okay.
Now, if for some reason on a later game you have to start with a chip that it's not a double, you place the smaller number towards you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be perpendicular with you.
And so we've got the dominoes kind of coming towards you right now, Armando. So as we play through, can you go the opposite direction? Or
Goes one direction? Because now it's my play. Now I can put on either side.
Okay.
So I need to match either the six on this side or the five that's now on this side.
Okay. That's
okay. So I look at my chips and I decide I want to play this one. So I'm going to play on the five. So now you got a six or a one.
Okay. I've got a six. I'm putting it down.
There you go. All right. So Jose now plays. He goes with a two. All right. There's a double. So now he places the double across.
Okay.
All right.
Doubles always go across.
The doubles always go across. All right. And there we go. So now I got to either play a six or a two. What's more convenient? Usually, you want to get rid of your doubles first.
Those ones are tougher.
Yeah. But it depends, because if you're playing, if you got many, you just put a double one. So if you got many ones, maybe you want to keep it, because you're playing a strategy to make everyone else pass because you got the ones.
Right.
All right. So maybe you want to try to get ones on both ends. And then you got the double, so you only play, and you play with your double, so everyone passes again,
mm-hmm.
and so you're way ahead of everyone else.
Okay, so the doubles could be a good thing.
Could be a good thing. All right, here's a situation right there. 1 and 1. I don't have one, so usually you indicate by knocking on the table.
Uh-huh.
And you knock on the table to say you passed.
Okay.
Most of the time you also say it, pass.
All right. Well, so now I've got a situation where I've got a 1, and there's 1 on either end, so does it matter where I put it?
It doesn't matter. You can place it on any of both ends.
I'm getting an indication that I should put it down here. Maybe he could be playing for himself.
Oh, he's saying, okay, so you go by on your right. Okay. But it wouldn't make a difference in the result. Okay. Usually when you get to the edge of the table,
mm-hmm.
you turn and start putting them to the side.
Okay.
Okay, and the actual rule should be that you turn to the right as you're facing the row of dominoes.
Started
so for one thing, like for example, it's my turn. It's a 0 or a blank and a 1.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say I turn this chip up. Mm-hmm. That's not a good chip. So now I have to leave it in view, plain view, okay? And I got to play it as soon as possible.
So that was like you made a mistake by showing your hand.
I made a mistake. I shouldn't have shown that chip because I cannot play it.
Right, okay.
All right, so now it stays in plain view. Everyone knows that I have that chip, and I got to play it as soon as either a 6 or a 3 in this case.
You must default to it.
You have to, yes. So in my case, I don't lose my turn. I still get to play.
Okay.
So I put the double blank.
Okay. You got me a good hand here. This is good. I got a blank. All right. I'm putting it down.
Okay. See, he turned again
mm-hmm.
like we were going counterclockwise. All right. So blank 4. I still cannot play that chip that's turned upside down.
Mm-hmm. That's...
He passed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is Phoenix.
And he's done.
So did he win then?
Yeah. He ran out of chips. He won. Whoever
gets rid of him
first. Gets rid of him first is the winner. That's it.
And then so is there any second or third place?
No. Actually, what we do is we add up all of the chips that are left.
Uh-huh.
So we got 6, 15, 18, 24, 30 points. And he gets 30 points or... Basically, as a partner, since he's across of me on the table, we get the 30 points.
Mm.
Okay, so the couple gets 30 points. It's always the scoring is kept by couples.
And it's the person with the highest or lowest that wins?
The highest. You want to get to 200 points, or if you run out of time, whoever has the most points at that point in time is the winner.
So was this a pretty quick match of dominoes that we just played?
That was normal.
That was normal?
Yeah. But again, this is only 1 and we only got 30 points. So we still got to play several hands before we get to 200.
Well, Armando Capo with the World Domino Council, thank you so much for coming in and showing us how to play a game of dominoes. And good luck with the tournament.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And also thanks to our guests.
Thank you.
I got an update from Armando Capo over the weekend about the results of the Domino tournament. He told me the number one ranked player from it is Rafi Rosa of Puerto Rico. To find out more about Dominoes and Engineers Without Borders, visit our webpage, wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.